Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the return of African stolen artifacts by former European colonial masters. I'm joined by a very special guest, Molemo Moilo. I hope I've pronounced it well.
That
was pretty close to it, yeah. Executive Director and co-founder of the Open Restitution Africa, based in South Africa. The Open Restitution is an African-led project that is seeking to open up access to information on the restitution of African material and cultural and many more. Molemo, I've read your profile, and I'm, like I was saying, I'm quite impressed by what you're doing, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Brilliant. So let me start off. So your organization, the Open Restitution, has given this a very staggering number of artifacts from Africa that was stolen during the colonial era, about, I think, 1 million. And out of that, we've had less than, I would say, in my opinion, less than 1% of that has been returned so far, which is quite concerning. How do you see this to begin with? This what I would term historical injustice and sort of that is rooted in colonialism, imperialism. How do you see this?
I think the important thing with restitution and the staggering amount of African heritage that is outside of the continent is that it is a kind of a centering point of a much bigger conversation about African history and also about African futures, in the sense that where it is, of course, really important to return a lot of our heritage back to the African continent. In fact, what most Africans speak to when we think about restitution is also about rebuilding all of the knowledge that was lost and to reconnect with many of the spiritual practices that were lost, that these items across the world connect with. And so when we think about restitution, we do think about the movement of human beings or the movement of objects, our belongings from Europe back to Africa. But we're actually concerned with a much bigger epistemic and intellectual, emotional, and spiritual conversation that's much bigger and much broader.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because in the last, I think it was the last year or last 2 years, they had this theme of the African Union stuff, and it was all about reparation. And we've had, matter of fact, I've had the Commissioner of Human Rights from South Africa. So we've had one episode on reparation at the can you hear me? At the continental level in Africa. So, and it was someone from Human Rights Commission from South Africa that did that episode. And we had another lady from another academic from America looked at reparation from the transatlantic slave trade of America. So we've been having these kind of conversations. And one of the things that they've mentioned, that you've mentioned as well, is also beyond the material essence, is the deeper level, the connotations, the symbolism of this thing to Africa, what we've lost. Because sometimes when we talk about reparation, we're talking about the physical objects or monetary, but we're not talking about the spiritual aspect. Can you delve deep into that?
Absolutely. We're about to launch our data platform, which is a central repository of everything that we've been gathering since we began in 2020. And one of the elements of our data repository, which will be available from the 1st of April, 2026, is really interesting reflections of a number of researchers from across the African continent looking at case studies of restitution processes across Africa, either ones that have already been returned or those that are still in progress. And one of the things that we measure there is what really is the intention of restitution. What do Africa say is the intention of restitution? And you'll see there that the significance that people associate with restitution does include a much wider set of concerns. And one of the major ones is intellectual, so knowledge creation, that we've lost a lot of knowledge along the way, and that there's the potential to rebuild certain kinds of knowledge through restitution. And some of this knowledge, which often isn't part of the restitution conversation in the public sphere, is even things like the oldest human-made object within mathematics, like that shows counting, is from Congo and is not in Congo, right? Or some of the most precious dinosaur collections in the world are from Tanzania, right? And so when we're talking about knowledge, we're not just talking about cultural knowledge, we're talking about scientific knowledge as well. And these are the kinds of things that we would look to rebuild around our own histories in together with the knowledges that we have inherited from the colonizer, right? But to teach our children that mathematics isn't something that just came from the West, but is something we built ourselves, is the kind of rebuilding people really want to do. And then spiritual is also vital. A number of the most sort of pressing and community-driven restitutions are very concerned with spiritual issues. Many of those are the return of what in museum language is called human remains, what we call our human ancestors. And that's actually people who were collected by all sorts of Europeans who are being returned slowly. And there, there's a big conversation about what it means to lay people to rest within the kinds of humanist practices of the African continent. But there are also other things that are part of, for example, age mate initiation processes, festivals for the harvest, or other kinds of ceremonies and practices that are in a sense spiritual, but also in a sense cultural, that in many communities, the act of demanding them back and engaging in negotiation for restitution has already been an initiation of reclaiming these practices that have been lost. So even just in the process of demanding them, there are many communities that have started to reinstate ceremonies that had been lost over time that were associated with these things that have been taken from them. So you see how the return is not simply always about putting something in a museum. In many cases, it's also about living culture and living practices across the continent.
You know, I'm glad where we started, because I've just put the obvious physical return of these artifacts behind. We will still talk about them. They're also very important. But we're talking about the more symbolic and more important ones. So you mentioned something about how knowledge, in terms of like teaching Africans about knowledge, and so I'll call it civilizations. And that ties into the current book I'm working on, where I'm looking at democracy and militarization and challenging the adoption of liberal democracy and its utility in Africa. No, that's okay. What I'm going to look at. And looking at that, sometimes we externalize our problem. But I guess the question is, how much are we in Africa? And I'm quite grateful that you've started, and I know there'd be a number of people that have started that. But what is the scope of the voice in Africa that is making this very, very vital information readily available to the African populace?
Unfortunately, within restitution, it's quite limited. So when you speak to the average African on the streets, I think most people have an opinion about restitution and have some level of connection. There's an extraordinary number of people who would even have a certain kind of personal connection. The number of people who will raise, oh, my great-great-grandfather was, you know, disappeared, or the chief of my mother's village, you know, these kinds of stories are often present. But in terms of what restitution processes entail, what they take to achieve, this knowledge is almost invisible. And this is the main research that we make visible with the DOT platform that we're launching next week, is how to do restitution, how to negotiate, how long does it take, who do you speak to, these kinds of questions, which are complex questions. It's not a single answer for every case. But I think one of the things that is most lacking, in fact, is the question of, okay, and then what, right? Is the question of when something is returned, who does it go to and what for? That conversation is not happening enough on our continent. And the reason that conversation is really important is that because most of the resources come from Europe, they are concerned with museums, right? But museums are not necessarily African strategies for memory. They're not necessarily the primary way that we want to integrate our heritage into our everyday lives. And so there does need to be a much more detailed conversation about what that means. And there are many options, but also how these questions of culture integrate into so many other elements of our lives, right? It's not part of the problem with thinking that these objects should simply be returned to museums, is that much of how museums work in Africa is things go there to be forgotten and maybe school children will visit, but they're not necessarily part of our conversations about power, about how we relate to our former colonial masters, about how we understand our own modes of governance and organizing, because many of the things that were taken were also taken in moments of conflict and war for a very particular reason. They were taken as part of a destruction of existing governance frameworks, existing power frameworks, right? And part of the challenge of their return is that in many cases, those frameworks have disappeared or are contested. So for example, in many cases, they're taken from what we might call royal households, right? Because in the conflict between a colonizer and whoever was in power in the early colonial period, so this is things that were taken in, say, the 1800s, it was often a conflict with the king or the chief. And what was taken was in part a destruction of that king or that chief's authority. And so when that's returned, it's often returned into a contemporary African context in which those questions of authority are not entirely resolved, right? So when we talk restitution, we're also talking about African governance structures that are unfinished business of the kind of decolonial project, right? It's not purely something that goes into a museum and isn't forgotten. It's part of a contemporary conversation of rural to urban relationships, which are and will continue to be major questions for the African continent as we urbanize and as greater sort of difference in income levels, living cultures, histories, political affiliations really shift between urban and rural populations. Often these inheritances are, you know, when something is returned, our museums are in cities. And yet they were taken from what is today considered a rural area. So what does it mean to return something to a country, but not necessarily to its people? Or in other cases, taken from a community who today cross a border of the Berlin Conference, right? So is it returned to which country based on the fact that these peoples actually cross a border, a national border? These are the unfinished sort of African questions that still dog us and are reignited through restitution in a way.
But you see, what is your response, like, reflects the complexity of, and that's why I was saying, not just the physical artifact, but what that physical artifact represents in terms of so what I can see from there, you talked about ownership. You've also talked about also it also speaks to the arbitrary creation of states in Africa. Now, you know, all of this affects ownership, aspect nationality, identity, and all of this kind of questions that we're talking about. But does that itself justify the argument by these European colonial powers in terms of retaining these artifacts? And how do we resolve all of these complexities?
Yeah. So there's multiple answers to that question, I think. The first one is to say that most of Europe now, by and large, is open to the conversation of restitution, not just to Africa, but to the rest of the world as well. Mm. There are a few countries, well, one, Britain, that the national government hasn't come on board. And then there are a few specific objects, specific belongings that are not fully engaged with. So for example, the Germans have been very active in restitution, but they will not have a conversation about Nefertiti. And Nefertiti is one of their most precious objects, you know, but in terms of sort of international representation and museum visitor numbers and things. She is very high up there, and they won't open a conversation about her, for example. But by and large, the conversation has opened up significantly. And the challenge we see now is much more around the question of process, where I think there's a significant issue with the fact that restitution has become a kind of competition between Europeans to be seen to be progressive. Europeans competed when they were collecting. So, for example, France is known to have collected most of the most precious things. Britain has collected most of the most important things. Germany was late to the collection game and wanted to differentiate their collecting strategy. So they collected the most things, just in terms of numbers, right? Now there's a competition to give back. But what that means is that the priority is not with repairing African issues, right? The priority is with the fact that their museums are too full, the fact that the cost of maintaining their museums is increasingly difficult as Europe moves to the right and funding for museums drops. The fact that they are under pressure from their own populations as well as African diaspora populations to return things. It's not necessarily about repair. And some of the conversations I've had with museum professionals is to say that, you know, when you took these things, it was part of a process of destroying the continent. And so when you return them, you can't expect the continent to be easy and comfortable and perfect, right? Mm. Part of the process of return is a process of repair. And that means that restitution takes time. And sometimes even from an African perspective, we tend to want to rush the process. You know, we feel not enough has been returned. And in certain cases, there are very clear lines of, we know exactly which community they have structures to receive something. You know, there's a very clear process and those are delayed. But there are other processes where more complex and broader conversations need to be had to address localized challenges. And that is part of the process of restitution. To restore, to restitute is not simply to hand back a thing, right? It is to be in relation. And you see this with an early report that really sort of sparked a lot of the restitution conversation in Europe from France, which is the South Savoie report, in which they title it a new relational ethic, right? Restitution is about a new ethics of relationship between Africa and Europe. Mm-hmm. And a new relationship has to be built and things have to move at the speed of trust. You know, it's not simply just putting something on a plane and sending it off and hoping for the best. And I think a lot of what Africans need to be able to do is to say that to Europeans, that you don't get to take these things refuse to return them for, in some cases, 100, 150 years. And then when you are ready, try and rush a process, try and not engage with the difficulties of the process, pretend that things must be perfect and easy for you in order for you to return. I think we need to be able to challenge that expectation.
Malema, you know what interests me and what also irritates me is that most of the what we call advancements in Africa in modern terms is usually from external pressure. So we'll see, you mentioned the Savoy report, which is external in France. So what is the scale? And I've always said this, that the change that Africa desires has to emanate from internal struggles, internal conditions, internal circumstances. So I guess the question is, what is the scale of pressure from within Africa for these artifacts? What is the level of influence that Africa is having in these conversations or these narratives? And that will be one. And also you mentioned restitution. I think let's just deal with this, then I come to what I want to ask about the restitution. I'm not conflating two questions anymore.
Sure. So again, I think there's two ways to answer this question. The first is that we have written about, and you can find on our website, the fact that Africans have been demanding return almost immediately in many cases. There's been research, a great report actually from Germany, but other research reports that in many cases, Africans immediately pushed back on things being taken. And there are a few cases in which, in fact, something was returned within an immediate period of time because the pressure from Africans was so strong. Africans have also been demanding their restitution for 200 years. And that is a really important part of the narrative that I think gets invisibilized with the South Savoie report kind of conversation. There was a very strong momentum for restitution in the sort of 60s and 70s that emerged after the sort of independence across the African continent and Africans really pushing for the ability to kind of redefine ourselves after independence and recognizing the need for culture to be part of this process. And that was being done both within sort of the museum world, in spaces such as Festac, for example, in Nigeria, or even just at a national level, Mobutu Sese Seko made quite an important speech at the UN. Around that period, there was also the first ever head of the International Council of Museum. No, I lie. He was the head of culture at UNESCO, who was from Africa, first ever from Africa. And he really pushed the restitution drive forward. And in that period, you see a lot of visibility for the restitution question. You also see a very distinct pushback from Europe. They really quite starkly refuse in many cases. There are letters even from, say, European diplomats in Africa, you know, making a claim, making an argument for return as part of a relationship with independent African countries, and European museums point blank refusing. So I think one of the things is narrative. It's how we tell the story, in the sense that we've done some research around how, for example, media talks about restitution and the fact that global media is far more likely to quote, reference, and engage with Europeans about African restitution than it is likely to bother to find Africans to talk to. And of course, some of that is the limitation of African spaces, African media spaces, platforms like this one, which are vital to counterbalance that kind of conversation, right? So some of it is a problem of narrative. It's not that Africans haven't been present, haven't pushed, haven't driven this conversation. It's that Europeans have overtaken the narrative. The second part of that, however, is some challenge around the fact that the relationship between states and African communities around restitution can sometimes be complex, in the sense that it has now become general consensus, except in a few dodgy cases, Britain again, that when restitution happens, it should happen between two states, because restitution usually happens from a European state because of legal frameworks to an African state, but also that because of the 1970 UNESCO framework that's put in steps to avoid looting, you need a lot of legal support to even move something precious across borders, right? So there is usually a kind of state-to-state conversation. They have historically been, and then Britain did recently, state-to-community restitutions. But this is problematic because you have a very powerful state restituting to a community and ignoring the African state and ignoring African sovereignty in that sense, right? By and large, we don't want this situation. The challenge, though, with going through African states is that African states have lots to deal with, big problems, right? And so restitution is not always at the top of their priority list. And that is fair enough, right? We're dealing with education, we're dealing with urbanization, housing, in some cases, conflict. There's a lot to deal with, and so restitution is not always at the top of the list. When restitution is at the top of the list, it can also sometimes be problematic because it's used for political purposes. And so you've seen, for example, in Namibia, restitution of human ancestors has been very well supported by the state as part of a broader conversation around reparations for genocide, the German genocide of Nama and Herero peoples in Namibia. However, what that has often meant is that there is resources and support for the movement of our human ancestors from Europe to Namibia, but then not as much support for actually laying these people to rest. And so these people have, in some cases, been left in the basement of Namibian museums. And we know that that's not why we're trying to restitute. You know, it's not our intention to really replicate, in a sense, the fact that our ancestors, you know, sit in a box in a basement. So sometimes political influence isn't necessarily, you know, or overt political support isn't necessarily what you want. So, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, you said so many amazing stuff that I really love. And you're very smart, Mulemwa. Yeah, I like that. I said that with all honesty. One of the things that I've set this up is for us to, because I looked at it and it's to have our stories have been told by other people. And you don't blame people. People always say stories from our perspective. We're all biased, whichever way we're going to look at it. And that's one of the things that has influenced the center to have someone that is led who can say our story in an unbiased form. And another thing you mentioned as well, because I want to talk about restitution, you talk about the states, people. Unfortunately, we live in the Westphalian kind of state where the state is the one that is vested with the power authority to do this. But African states don't usually have the interest of the people. So you have where there's the difference between the elites in Africa that have captured the state and the people. And then you mentioned education as well. So I guess, you know, from coming to all of this, we're talking about restitution itself. I've seen in Nigeria where till tomorrow, they're still restituting or returning the money, billions of money that have been stolen by this former dictator. But you've not seen that impact in the ordinary people. You can't account for this money. So you begin to have a conversation and say, so what is the point of this restitution? How does it have impact? Like you mentioned, in the people that have been in the box, the actual people, are they being, you know, impacted by this? So I guess my question is this: how do we do restitution right? And that would be one question. And two, why do we have so much resistance to restitution? Because I think it was just yesterday we've seen the president of Ghana raise stuff in the UN for slavery as the gravest whatever, and then we've seen so much kickback or so much resistance from the United States, from different other countries. Why are these former people that have benefited immensely over centuries from this, why are they resisting restitution?
So I'll start with the second question around resistance. I mean, I think, I don't know for sure, but I think that it's a question of debt, in the sense that initially we sort of demanded independence and, you know, they kind of struggled to do that and then eventually agreed to that. And then we demand something more and then we demand something more. And this is because they have taken so much, right? And there are a number of interesting people. I mean, I think Ashile Mbembe spoke to the fact that you can never return what you have taken.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like you have taken so much from us, it is impossible to repay your debt. And what you hear from the British Museum, for example, is that if they give one thing back, then they have to give another thing back. And in the case, for example, that I mentioned of Namibia, if you start to give back human ancestors, then we have to admit to the genocide, which did happen, right? That those two things were related to each other, restitution and an apology for the genocide happened.
And acceptance of, yeah.
Right. Yeah. But they haven't got to the point of reparations as yet. No, so like every step means they have to admit further and further to the degree of devastation that they wrought upon. And I think it feels like if you open the door just a little bit, then, you know, it'll flow completely. And older Africans who've been at this work much longer than me have referred to how at some point they started to argue for long-term loans rather than restitution as a way to open the crack of the door, you know, or they stopped to talk about reparations or financial things as a way to crack open the door, you know, and these are the kinds of strategies that Africans have had to take. And that kind of comes to your first question, which was, what's the best way to do restitution? And I think the answer there is that we don't yet have a best way to do it. And that is in large part because it's somewhat new. And so it's still an evolving practice and methodologies are emerging. But it's also because restitution cases are so different. So, for example, there's an incredible case in our research called the Tuka Mosque, which is from Cameroon, in which the traditional practice of this mosque was that a new one was created every so often. I don't know the exact details of how they would decide a new one was created, but they didn't have the same obsession with authenticity and the object that Europeans do. No, this is a European preoccupation, and they would make a new one. And so making a new one is not a problem. That's not the issue. The problem is that within the history of the Tuka Mosque, a process had to be undertaken by a secret society of moving the spirit from the old Tuka Mosque to the new Tuka Mosque. And because the old Tuka Mosque is at the Quai Bondy in Paris, France, they haven't been able to undergo the usual process since that Tuka Mosque was taken, I believe, in the 1950s during the colonial wars against France in Cameroon. And so in a sense, the original object is not their priority. Their priority is the transfer of the spirit. It's not to say that they don't want the return of the original, as it stays, of course, but their number one priority is, in fact, the transfer of the spirit, in large part because the mosque is part of a really important festival that is undertaken, I think, every year, and brings together a large swath of the Bamindu people. They have reignited the festival since making a new mosque. They have kind of restarted processes that were lost in the aftermath of the colonial wars, and they are reclaiming that heritage and that memory, but they need the spirit, and they need the mosque in order to transfer the spirit. That's very different, say, to the Ngadji drum from Kenya, where they need the drum. And the drum has never been displayed, as far as I know, at the British Museum. It's always been in the basement. The British don't need that drum. But the people, the Pokoma people of Kenya, need the drum as part of ceremonies that are life-giving to their peoples. And it's specifically the sound of that drum that is needed. And so they need the drum to create the sound. So in each case, it's slightly different. Those are cases where a community is very clear of what they've lost and what they need. In some other cases, and for example, in Germany, this is often the case, is that Germany took a very ethnographic approach. And so, you know, when we say 1 million objects, sometimes it's 50 of the exact same spoon, you know, because their approach was to have many as part of a kind of scientific
research. But like the British and the French, yeah.
Right. They have so many of the same thing. You know, they pull open a drawer in the storerooms of their museum, and it's just, you know, just the same necklace exactly the same necklace, 20 of them, you know? And in those cases, we don't necessarily want to take on the burden of the fact that they were obsessed with collecting, right?
Mm.
Say we want all of those things back is to put ourselves in a position of difficulty where we now have to work out the care and cost of care of all of the things that they were obsessed with collecting, but in our culture, we very likely might have made a new one. But in order to make a new one, we needed to have the old one. Or in order to make a new one, we needed to have the knowledge of how they were made. And in many cases, there are things where, you know, we've worked with researchers who go into communities and show usually a picture of something in a museum, trying to find a community member who remembers this thing, this object, and who remembers what it was for and remembers what it's made of, you know, because in many cases, the Europeans don't know. They don't. They have all these hundreds of thousands of things in their storerooms, and they don't actually have records for all of them. Sometimes they don't even know exactly where they came from. So we can't take responsibility for that obsession. And so in those cases, we don't necessarily want every single one of those necklaces returned or every single one of those spoons returned. What we're maybe more interested in is a few of them that are housed within our context in a way that we can rebuild the knowledges of what they were used for, how they were made, that they might feed into new innovations, new cultural practices, you know, new artistic practices, and deciding, you know, how many do we need for that is not always a kind of clear assertion. And this is why we also need time, right? We can't be saying bring everything back because like in many cases, we have a case in the data platform where something was likely restituted to, somebody was likely restituted to the wrong country because of these cross-border communities. It was probably taken from one country and it was returned to a different one. We really don't want to have this kind of situation on a large scale. So it does take some effort and some focus. And I think what we really are in need of is increased sort of commitment to trying to think through this from a, I guess to a degree, a policy perspective, but even just an enablement perspective from our states is what are the things they're going to prioritize? You know, how do they apportion potentially resources which are inevitably limited to the most urgent cases. In cases where there may not be resources, sometimes the need is just to get out of the way of communities that are already coordinating and organizing and to facilitate. There have been cases, for example, where customs becomes a major limitation to restitution because in many cases, an object is in fact very worthwhile, you know, it's worth a lot of money on the commercial market. And so that amount is put on the insurance documentation, on the customs documentation. And when it's shipped over to Africa, then a museum has to pay some huge sum of money to release something from customs because that's the law. And that, you know, the estate hasn't necessarily made special rules and dynamics for restitution that it shouldn't be treated like a car or a plastic.
So I look at this in two ways. So on a lighter note, which is, it might be lighter, but it's still very important. You were talking about the mask in
how, positive note, yes.
Yeah, the positive, and how is the transfer of the spirit and all of that. You know, I've always had this in the past that a lot of times when people are coming, the mass migration, that sometimes might be the spirits of that are calling to them. You're responding to that spirit. Sometimes I'm Igbo, though I didn't grow up there. But when I hear the sound of the you know, the flute made from the wood, when you just hear it in the songs, there's that place it takes you to that you can't really explain what it is. So can we then say, looking at all this kind of logistics, looking at all these, you know, we don't necessarily need all of this. There are some that are very important, like the drum, like it is that you need to return. But there, should you not pay some sort of tax to every people from that community? Like, pay, because people do come, because now I want to touch on the economic importance of museums. and how people over the years have come, paid to come to the museums, and what the states in Europe have benefited from housing this stuff, should we not pay, should African, no, should we not link it to the migration system, how people are migrating out of conflict, and all of, you know, how sometimes, if I look at the African epistemology we're talking about, and then the spiritual kind of like, and how the absence of that, my representative God could be causing conflict, could be causing wars, could be causing all of this poverty. So should we not translate that into compensating these communities by paying some sort of tax that come, and then whatever needs to be kept in Europe, you want to keep it, but you need to pay. Has that been considered?
To some degree, in the sense that ownership rights are not necessarily the same as possession, right? In some cases, there's the potential, for example, with the Tuka mask, I think it would be necessary to identify that it belongs to the Bamendu people, not to the Kebronli, even if it stays in the Kebronli, right? That it would be transported to this area, that the rituals would be undertaken, that the spirit would be moved. And if it is returned to the Kebronli, it still belongs to the Bamendu people. And in that case, any revenues that are made, because in certain cases, they're not a lot, but there are certain cases, Nefertiti, for example, where that museum makes insane amounts of money, not just in tickets specifically to see Nefertiti, but they sell copies. And I can't remember the exact amount, if you Google it, you can find it, but it's I think hundreds, if not thousands of euros for a copy, right? So they're literally making copies and selling them. And in that case, you know, Egypt, for example, is, when we talk about 90 to 95% of African material heritage, historical African material heritage outside of the continent, we're mostly talking about sub-Saharan Africa. And the main shifter there is Egypt, where Egypt still has a lot of its history in Egypt, right? It's recently opened, I can't remember the exact name, the Grand Museum, and they hold a lot of their own history. They have done a process of reclaiming, for example, Egyptology, growing the population of Egyptian Egyptologists, locally grown people who in Egypt, if you want to undertake research, sort of going into the pyramids or, you know, undertaking archaeological research, you have to work with Egyptian teams. It's like part of the way that you get the allowance to work there. No, these are all the kinds of economic, but economic in the broader sense of all these Egyptologists that are now being employed, departments of universities that have grown. There's a recent book by Monica Hanna, who's done some really leading work in restitution in Egypt, that's selling around decolonizing Egyptology. You know, this is the broader economy of restitution. There's also been some work around, and we've developed a podcast around digital restitution and the complexities of the digital side of restitution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the copies I mentioned being sold of the Nefertiti are physical copies, but Europe has undertaken a big drive to digitize their collections, in part to put them online and make them accessible as records. That is all part of, you know, the kind of objects of ownership that in principle should be Africans. But the way intellectual property works is that if you make a copy, it's your copy, right? The kind of WIPO, International Intellectual Property Framework, means that if you're going to hand over the ownership of, say, 3D scans, you also need to hand over the property right, and there's specific ways of doing that. And those are the kinds of things that end up being used in, say, films or in on book covers and this kind of thing. And that's the broader economy around restitution.
Now, before I come to the last question, I want to ask this. There have been, you know, like every debate, you have on the different eye, you have sympathizers and have apologies. But we've had apologists, and we've had, I particularly mentioned, you were mentioning Britain, and I wanted to talk about a different the different responses from Britain and the rest. But we've had this, we currently have this opposition leader whose origin is from Nigeria, but has been some sort of apologies for the colonial for during the colonial slavery. She's presented the colonial time in a milder form to what we know it to be. So what do you say to these when people want to revise history in this way or present history in this way, what is your how do you see this? And then on top of that, since we're talking about Britain now, why is Britain a bit different from the others? Then I'll come to the last question.
Okay, so why is Britain different from the others? You know, I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. I mean, in a way, I think its collection style, you know, I told you that there was kind of competition between countries. Because Britain had such broad tentacles at a very particular period in which the West became obsessed with collecting, it had a kind of, what's the word, it was a little bit ahead of others in that it was all over the world at exactly this moment. And so it's in a way considered as having some of the most important things. And, you know, how things are determined as most important and who determines them as most important is obviously problematic. Mm-hmm. But I think this is part of the issue. You know, Germany, for example, they have done much better and they are, you know, they have to be given their dues for returning much more than, say, a France, who are often given much more visibility about restitution but don't actually return very much. But Germany has a lot more, you know, just in terms of quantity. And in many cases, they have things that are less, except for maybe the Benin bronzes, many of the things that have been returned from Germany are a little bit less politically complex, you know, both within the African continent and within Europe. So I can't really say why Britain has been so difficult, but I think that this is part of it. I think Britain also is going through a very, sort of like America, going through a very difficult moment of having to sort of face the lack of empire, right, in a bigger political question of Brexit, etc. Mm-hmm. And those museums are in many ways the kind of icon of empire. And so when they're having to face up to the fact that they're no longer super wealthy and, you know, very powerful and have major poverty issues and these kinds of things, the British Museum is one of the ways that they hold on to some old memory of greatness, mm-hmm. I think, in a way that maybe, for example, at Germany, for one thing, they're much more practiced at giving things back because there was a solid legal framework for restitution of Nazi taken art and other things from Jewish people. But their empire is long gone. And in your other question was about apologists. I mean, I think the apologist in Britain, there's nothing that can be said about that particular person. I think it would be a waste of time. One of the ways that I would speak to sort of apologists in Europe is that there's really important work done by the diaspora. The diaspora, there are many examples of incredible work by the diaspora for restitution. And most of them are cases in which, for example, there's a Sierra Leonean case in which the diaspora paid to buy something back off the market in, I think, the late 1800s, early 1900s. So there are those kinds of examples, but there are also increasingly examples in which the diaspora not only will fight, the African diaspora not only will fight for things from their own communities, but for example, in the Ngonso case in Germany, the diaspora has been of incredible support to Cameroonian activists pushing to get Ngonso returned and helping kind of facilitate issues like visas, you know, the invitation letters and those kinds of issues. So I would leave it up to the diaspora in a sense to address those issues. And for example, there's a great organization, Afford, and many others in Britain doing that work, even at a kind of policy level. Within the African context, we also have many apologists, I think. Often the apologists in the African continent are concerned with the issue of our ability to look after what is given to us. And I don't think that this is a question that should be ignored. You know, I think sometimes we sort of bat it away as an apologist issue. It is a bigger question. In the sense that the commercial market for these objects is very robust. There are people whose jobs it is to travel the world and steal things, you know, and managing the security and the cost of security of some of these very precious things is not
prohibitive.
It's not something we should ignore. I do think that part of that is still an issue of thinking that museums are the best way to manage restitution, and that these kinds of economic models that are failing in Europe now, even in the countries that, you know, like Britain is now considering charging a fee to the British Museum. And this is because European museum as an economic model is increasingly failing. To be building giant museums in Africa, you know, I think we need to question if that's the best approach. And I think there does need to be a real conversation about the resources required to do restitution, because those resources still remain primarily in Europe. The work that Africans are doing for restitution is largely unpaid. So I think it's, you know, it's part of a conversation of reparations and such. That would be my answer for the apologists.
I like that. We can, you know, just move to the background the valid concern of those that and I like how you've answered, but another thing again is to ask the last question is, how do we, because I think again in all of this we've not talked about education and the knowledge of just the average African. So bearing that in mind, in terms of the importance, the role of education, the role of history and all of this in our curriculum and all of that, what do you see this kind of shift, this kind of restitution debate and narrative, what do you see this panning out in the short, medium and long term?
So, I mean, I think there's like the more direct potential for integrating this into school curriculums and having children learn about our heritage and, you know, this kind of thing. But I think one of the things that's most exciting for me is actually thinking, and this is maybe a bit related to the apologist question, is thinking about the change in education for African museum professionals and related roles, in the sense that the way that we've approached museums is very European. And it's not really within a general sort of cultural framework that's very viable on the African continent. And you see this because museums don't necessarily do that well. And what you see from African museum professionals, because they are at the forefront of a lot of restitution, because Western museums have these objects, these people want to talk to African museums because it feels like they're talking to someone who understands them. And you see a radicalization happening in African museums. And I think this is really exciting. But at the same time, one of the things that you also see is that restitution, as we've discussed, is super complex and requires a set of skills that museum professionals are not trained to have. And those skills are skills of negotiation, are skills of conflict management, you know, are of engaging with a different people over difficult subjects, but also increasingly engaging with communities that are very angry about what has been taken from them, about contemporary political situations, lack of resources, etc. And so you find museums going into communities saying, okay, this museum wants to return this thing, it belongs to you, what should we do? And this is a really complex role to play, right? A big upward learning curve in terms of skills. And I think there's something interesting here about the kind of educational role museums can potentially play, where it's not simply about in schools. I do think that there's a lot of potential there and a lot of value there. But it's also about using museums as these kinds of facilitatory spaces where the questions of colonialism, the questions of culture, the questions of rebuilding and repair start to be centered in the museum. And the museum becomes a space that can start to educate adults and educate communities about histories, and conversations can happen that don't see museums always as the expert, but sometimes the communities are the expert, you know. And I think we're seeing some very exciting things happen in African museums, often with almost no resources, to start to play these kinds of roles. And in a way, it's a whole new imagination of what African museums can be, because we often think of them as these kind of dusty, under-resourced, falling apart spaces. But playing this role in a contemporary African context, I think, is vital. You know, every single African country needs more of this kind of conversation. And museums have very good relationships with schools already. And so this becomes a kind of space of thinking about education, not purely as curriculum, not purely as sort of telling children things they don't know, but making knowledge collectively is I think the most interesting educational space for now.
Brilliant. Mulemo, this has been a very exciting conversation. It's so rich. I've learned a lot as well in the conversation, and it's quite sad the richness that Africa possesses, and how you contrast that to the level of lack, and it's just unbelievable. So you're doing a very wonderful job in providing that information and providing the space for this kind of conversations to continue. I really appreciate the time, and I owe you for missing the time on Wednesday. I'll pay back. I'll restitute back to you. Don't worry. I'll do my
restitute. Absolutely.
Well, it's been an amazing time, and you know, I want to wish you a wonderful rest of your weekend, and enjoy your well-deserved weekend.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to share our work. And yeah, it's all available on our website, so we encourage anyone to just go learn more there.
Brilliant. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into what a wonderful topic and example as well of restitution and return of stolen artifacts from Africa. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, Mulemo Moila, for her read. And very invited. I really enjoyed this episode. I'm sure you would as well. But for now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next time.